last presentation is titled The Effects of Aerobic Exercise Intensity on Ambulatory Blood Pressure, a Look at Unmedicated Middle-Aged Hypertensive Males and Females. And our presenters are Derek, Ryan, Jamie, and Sarah.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for spending this Thursday afternoon with us. Jamie, Derek, Ryan, and myself are going to be presenting to you our systematic review on how we found that aerobic exercise programs of various intensities affect ambulatory blood pressure in unmedicated hypertensive males and females. So first of all, the obvious question, what is hypertension? The most important part of this slide is that you just see that it's defined as 140 over 90. So we know the normal is defined as 120 over 80, but hypertension as defined by the World Health Organization is 140 over 90. 140 systolic, 90 diastolic. So hypertension really is a massive epidemic right now. In case you didn't know, we were surprised to find this, but it's actually the most common reason why Canadians go and see their doctor or take medication. And as a result of that, no big surprise, $2.3 billion to the Canadian healthcare system. That number's from 2003, and I'm sure that has gone up a lot. It really is the silent killer. Most people don't realize that they have high blood pressure until it's too late or until something else down the line breaks down. So you can imagine high blood pressure, when you have that amount of force going through your blood vessels, that you get that continuous erosion within the vessels to the point where they can be close to bursting or rupturing, which is how you end up with it being the number one risk factor for stroke. And it can also affect organs down the line, as I mentioned, heart, your arteries down the line, and even your kidneys. So what's really important, and this is where our study started to look at the nitty-gritty, is it's well established that exercise can reduce blood pressure. But as what was brought up in a previous point, there's a difference between a statistically significant difference and a clinically significant difference. So just to set this up for you, if you had a blood pressure of 135 over 85, not even diagnosed as hypertension at that point, versus a blood pressure of 115 over 75, which is the lower one, you would have a 2 times higher risk of mortality and morbidity. So the numbers mean a lot. To continue on that, so we talked in the context of, 20 millimeters of mercury higher, 10 millimeters of mercury higher, even small changes can have a major effect on your health. So a 5 millimeter decrease in diastolic blood pressure, you can see the numbers there. You can, I think you could argue with the patient, it's up to the patient to decide what they find numbers are, relevant to them. 2 millimeter decrease, something really small. I mean, that happens over the course of when you're standing up to speak versus sitting in the chair, is associated with decrease in risks of coronary heart disease mortality and stroke mortality. So traditionally, as we all know, blood pressure is measured, it's called office blood pressure. When you go in to see your doctor or your physiotherapist, they put this big manometer on your arm. You put it on your arm, they insulate it. And they usually take one reading in the essence of time, but they are advised often to take 3 readings and take the average of those. Obviously, quick and convenient, it's how it's typically done. However, is that right? Blood pressure, as we mentioned before, fluctuates. It fluctuates with your moods over the course of a day, and you can imagine how many moods you can go through during a day. And one of those moods might be anxiety when you're sitting there getting your blood pressure taken and you're sitting with a doctor who may or may not tell you good or bad news. That's what we call white coat syndrome, and I'm sure you've all heard of that, but it's just when it's a documented phenomenon where patients have higher blood pressure than they typically have due to anxiety of having their blood pressure measured in a clinical setting. So there was lots of research on office blood pressure. and exercise primarily in the 90s. In the 2000s, there started to be lots of studies on this ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. We're going to call it AMBP from now on. And pretty much what this is instead of just taking your blood pressure at a single snapshot in time, you would wear the cuff around your arm, this exact same device, you'd wear it around your arm for 24 or 48 hours, and it takes measurements every 15 minutes, some every hour, it just depends on how you want to set it up. But really, you could track people's blood pressure over the course of a day or a night or both, and take the mean of that to have a better idea of what's going on. And it makes sense if you think about it. If you wanted to figure out if someone was a happy person or not, you wouldn't go take a snapshot of them, of their mood, you know, 2 days before they were about to take their P&E, right? You would probably want to see overall, in the course of a couple weeks, how does, or a couple days, how are their moods. The downfalls of this is that it is expensive, it's not quite readily available yet, and it can be disruptive to daily life in the sense that it is uncomfortable when the cuff inflates. So, I mentioned this before a little bit, but so we have office blood pressure, which is a traditional way of measuring hypertension and diagnosing hypertension and blood pressure, and we have AMBP, which the literature is increasingly showing that AMBP is deemed to be a much more accurate reflection of the patient's true blood pressure levels. And just give some quick examples of dippers versus non-dippers, and that they can predict your risk of a lot of comorbidities associated with hypertension based on if your blood pressure stays high when you're sleeping at night or if it dips at night and goes back to normal. And also office blood pressure versus AMBP blood pressure diagnosis. Office blood pressure, you know, if you walked into a doctor and you had high blood pressure versus if they could track you over the course of time, you might see a difference in whether or not you get diagnosed with it, with hypertension or not. Two noteworthy points, AMBP, the measurements, when they actually do them and they compare them to office blood pressure measurements, they usually find that they're lower. This has important implications, but if we end up diagnosing people with hypertension based on office blood pressure, they may or may not truly be hypertensive. Also, AMBP shows less change. There's less fluctuation when they take readings, in the sense I should specify. It shows less fluctuation. It shows more fluctuation because it follows you throughout the day, but in terms of consistency over days, it shows less change. So the typical hypertensive treatment right now is from the National Heart and Lung and Blood Institute, and this is what's the guidelines given to physicians. First and foremost, lifestyle modifications, and this is where we come in, as we heard from the other group, specifically exercise, and this is where we're going to go with this. Also, medication, it can be used concurrently or not at all. It really depends on what stage of hypertension you're at. So exercise, this is our MO. Who can quote me the normal ACSM exercise prescription for regular healthy adults? All right, well, we're going to quote you the exercise prescription that ACSM prescribes specifically for people with hypertension. So they say aerobic exercise performed for 20 to 60 minutes, big gap, 50 to 85% of heart rate reserve, another big gap, for 3 to 5 days per week. You can see there's a lot of variability in the fact that if someone exercised for 20 minutes at 50% of their heart rate reserve for 3 days a week, versus if they're at the opposite end of the spectrum of that recommendation, how different their levels of physical activity would be. Clinically, what we find is that physicians are being told to, through the same guidelines as I mentioned before, to prescribe their patients who have early stages of hypertension with moderate intensity aerobic exercise on most days of the week. Very basic. So we saw those and we thought, you know, as physiotherapy students and very soon physiotherapists, we are the exercise specialists. We need to be masters at exercise prescription. We need to know what the exact parameters are that will be the most effective for our patients and most likely for them to comply with. So, first of all, we wanted to know what is the most effective exercise prescription to reduce high blood pressure, and then specifically, what variables are most important within that fit prescription category. So we chose to look at intensity, and it's pretty surprising, but there are huge discrepancies in the literature. In past literature that was done using office blood pressure, primarily in the 90s, about what intensity is best. So I'll go to the second point, or the third point first. I mean, our hypothesis would be that higher intensities, if you did more higher intensity exercise, you would have greater reduction to blood pressure. However, a lot of the systematic reviews of the literature when they used office blood pressure found that low and moderate intensity exercise yielded the same results as high intensity. So we found that this was quite surprising, and therefore we wanted to take a closer look. So how is this relevant to you? I kind of touched on it already, but really, both doctors and physios alike, well, physios specifically, we need to be able to prescribe exercise that both leads to a clinically meaningful reduction in blood pressure and is also acceptable to the patient in terms of the fact that they are actually able to complete it and to comply with it. But really, we should be able to say to our patients, if you do this prescription of exercise, then in 6 weeks or however many weeks, you should be able to see this much of a reduction in blood pressure. Also, it could, depending on the on our findings, and just once you find that optimal prescription, that could lead to refinements in clinical practice guidelines and also adjusting the diagnosis of hypertension. So our aim was to systematically review the literature to determine the optimal intensity of an aerobic exercise program to yield the greatest reductions in ambulatory blood pressure. Ryan's going to talk to you about our methods.
All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we found the studies that we used for our review. First, here's our PICOS. So we kind of used the criteria here in our inclusion-exclusion criteria for after our initial search. So we did our initial search. We each kind of went through the papers and did a quick screen based on these couple of things. So we looked at, for the population, mostly things that were going to affect blood pressure, you know, their ability to exercise at different intensities. So blood pressure response at low versus high intensities for age-related changes, as well as if they were on medications or if they had multiple system impairment. And then we also narrowed our search down to aerobic exercise programs lasting more than 4 weeks, because aerobic exercise is the primary reason, or the primary method of exercise for decreasing blood pressure. And then we were going to compare exercise intensities and look at AMBP because it is the gold standard and there isn't a systematic review currently on it. And then we were also going to strictly look at randomized control trials. So what we did initially was we kind of opened up the search a bit to kind of see the literature that was out there. We ended up with 8 studies, 2 of which were randomized control trials, and we just kind of did our quality assessments on the rest of them as well to kind of see what the quality of these papers were and if they were acceptable. In the end, we ended up discarding them, but we did do an initial search with them in mind. So these were the databases that we used, all the basic ones. And we also looked at the Cochrane systematic reviews just to make sure that there wasn't anything up there already. So this is our search strategy for the most part. All that we really want to take away from this slide is that we had 3 kind of main groupings of terms, one for hypertension, so we grouped those together. The other one for the 24-hour or the ambulatory blood pressure measurement, so we grouped those together, as well as a whole slew of terms we use for exercise. So then with each of those group terms, we ended them together and we ended up with our 8 papers. So for our quality assessment, we had the PEDRO, like the other systematic reviews have shown. So we also added a couple of other things to the PEDRO, just what we thought would be more specific to our study. So we added two items from Van Tolder for compliance and dropout, because we thought that that was really important for our look at these studies, because, you know, if there's lots of dropout, then obviously the exercise is inappropriate for the population, as well as for construct validity. So we went about this by having two of our group members assigned to do quality assessments on the papers that we had selected. They each went through independently, and then they were compared afterwards. And for any of them that had discrepancies, we had a third group member assigned as a tiebreaker. And then in the end, we ended up removing, after looking at all the studies, we ended up removing three of the criteria from the Pedro scale, because we found that all the studies we chose, they all failed it. And we figured that this was because, especially in studies looking at exercise, it's really hard to blind the patient as well as the outcome assessor. Like, you know if you're exercising or not. It's not like taking a placebo pill. So we ended up getting rid of these because we didn't think that it really affected the studies, but it was making our scores lower than we thought that they should be. And then, of course, we went through the data abstraction through these papers as well, in the same method that we went through the quality assessment. So two reviewers and then another one for the tiebreaker. So Derek's going to talk about our results.
So the first part of the results here, Ryan kind of touched on, and I'm just going to hopefully show it in a little bit more clear way. So the results of our study selection, we used a search strategy that Ryan mentioned, and we use that on the six databases. And so in the middle, we have our database. On the left, how many articles we kept from that database, and on the right, how many we excluded. So as you can see here, we kept four from Medline, four from Embase, one from Pedro, none from Sport Discus or Cochrane, but one from CINAHL. And that gave us 10 in total. I think Ryan kept saying eight, but I'm not sure why he was saying that. Okay, so we had 10 in total that we did our quality assessment and our data abstraction on. And so we did a full assessment on those 10 papers. And then we decided that we wanted to only keep randomized control trials. So that left us with, we discarded two for being review articles. That may be where Ryan's going to take from. And six because they were pre and post study designs, so they had no control group. And that left us with two randomized control trials in our systematic review. So study number one here is done by Cooper, Moore, McKenna, and Riddick in 2000. The title of the paper was, "What is the magnitude of blood pressure response to a program of moderate intensity exercise, a randomized control trial of sedentary adults with unmedicated hypertension?" Sounds pretty good, exactly what we wanted. Blumenthal, Sherwood, Gillette, and Babiak in 2000, they had a study called "Exercise and Weight Loss Reduced Blood Pressure in Men and Women with Mild Hypertension, Effects on Cardiovascular, Metabolic, and Hemodynamic Functioning." And so this is a table here to just show the exercise intervention characteristics. So I wanted to look at what really showed clearly what the intervention was doing. So for Cooper, they were the intervention group was a walking group that was unsupervised. They were supposed to do that for 30 minutes, and that was five times a week, and the intensity was moderate. So they were told, they were given accelerometers and told to exercise at a rate that would ensure they were expending 150 to 200 kilocalories in their 30 minutes. This program lasted 6 weeks, as opposed to Blumenthal, who was quite a bit longer. They did 24 weeks, so four times as long, and a little bit different setup. They did cycling, ergometry, walking, and then eventually jogging. They progressed in that. The duration of the session, they started with a 10-minute warm-up, did 35 minutes of the cycling or walking or jogging, and then a 10-minute cool down, and the intensity was at 70 to 85% of heart rate reserve, and they did this less frequently, so 3 to 4 times per week, and this was a supervised program. So the data that we got, the ambulatory blood pressure measures pre and post intervention. So for the control group, that's the second line there, It really didn't change too much. There was no statistical significance in the change. It looks like a slight increase, actually. Whereas in the intervention group, the systolic and diastolic blood pressures for mean ambulatory actually decreased. And this was kind of confusing. I had to read it quite a few times in the paper. They state there was a significant decrease in ambulatory systolic and diastolic blood pressure, as you can see by these numbers. 139.8 changed to 137 after 6 weeks. Diastolic 89.5 changed to 87.7. But this was not statistically significant. So it was a significant decrease, but not statistically significant. And Blumenthal was looking at a whole whack of things in their study, and they did not report any ambulatory blood pressure values. So they did state that ambulatory blood pressure was significantly different between all the groups. So they had a weight management and exercise only and a control group. And they stated that the systolic and diastolic ambulatory blood pressures were significantly lower in the intervention groups and versus the control groups. They gave p-values, but they did not actually state the results. So this meant we were unable to do any data synthesis. We could not do any meta-analysis or forest plots because only one study in our systematic review actually reported data that included means and standard deviations.
Okay, so after all that, what did we really end up with? So in the summary of the findings, like Derek just said, there weren't really very many high-quality studies in the literature. A lot of them used poor methodology, had kind of strange setups. So what we ended up with was two papers that met our search criteria. Like Derek said, Cooper's intervention didn't show a significant difference from pre to post as far as statistics go. So in that case, we can't really say that it made a difference in terms of blood pressure. Blumenthal's group suggested that there was a significant decrease, but didn't give us specific values, so we don't really know what to do with that, right? So in each of these cases, it's not just important that there is a change, but also we need to know the magnitude of the change to determine how important that actually is. So as far as the limitations of the literature go, there are very few studies right now on AMBP with high levels of evidence. And that makes it really challenging, especially when doing a systematic review where we want to have the highest level of evidence in order to come up with some good suggestions. A lot of them used a pre-post design. So basically, they didn't have a control group. They'd use the same group of people, take a measurement of blood pressure before their intervention, take a measurement of blood pressure after, which sounds all well and good, but it's hard to determine whether or not that blood pressure change is due to your intervention or a natural change that just would have happened over time. So it's almost like we have to discount those studies right away because they're not of the highest level of evidence. The other thing that was quite common was unsupervised exercise programs. While this might be the most realistic in terms of someone's everyday activity, if you look at the Cooper study, they basically said, okay, we want you to do this much exercise, off you go, and there wasn't really a whole lot of monitoring going on. So while that might be all well and good for, you know, a regular exercise program, it's not really very helpful for a study because nobody can really track how diligent they were with their exercise, whether they were exercising at the appropriate intensity, and so on. So all those variables that we're actually dependent on to get our results are a little bit unclear at that point. So those are throughout the whole literature. We found the limitations in the studies that we actually came up with at the end, kind of the same issue. So the first one was in the Cooper study, like I said, it was unsupervised, so we're unable to determine whether or not their changes were actually due to specific exercise intensities. And the big problem with these two studies is, well, the second one, sorry, is that they didn't report any means and standard deviations. So, I mean, it's one thing for someone to say it's statistically significant, but we need to know that magnitude to determine whether or not it makes a clinical difference and whether or not that's actually going to make a difference in the long run. And the last thing was the heterogeneity between studies out there. So we're trying to look at different exercise intensities and how that affects ambulatory blood pressure. But a lot of studies are going to use different measures of intensity. So where one study might use RPE, one study might use caloric expenditure, and one might use heart rate reserve, to try to compare those three studies and come up with an average intensity for each of them, it basically you're just introducing another source of error into your study. And we found that difficult because it was, you know, to compare apples and oranges, like it says on the slides, and what are you actually getting from, you know, from those studies? So as far as recommendations go, so previous research that was done before AMBP was quite good. Using office blood pressure, they use stringent exercise parameters, close monitoring. But basically what we suggest is that this needs to be redone now using ambulatory blood pressure, as it's the more accurate measure. We also need to systematically manipulate the FIT principles. So a lot of these studies are all over the place. Like, it's difficult to compare one that's 4 weeks long and, you know, 3 days a week to one that's 6 weeks long or 24 weeks long or whatever it is. So we need to be a little bit more systematic with the way that we change these studies. Also using randomized control trials that are supervised, stringent monitoring, and include all outcome data so that in further systematic reviews, all that information can be compared. And that's about it. Thank Darlene Renbach, who was a big help, Dr. Dan Anderson, a cardiologist who helped us, and as well as Charlotte, who did a lot of work with us for our research.
Thank you very much. Questions?
I was just wondering, you mentioned that you removed studies that had a large dropout rate, assuming that the dropouts were due to the fact that the interventions were inappropriate. Did you actually look at the reasons that some people were dropping out? Because I had a lot of people maybe going for surgery
We didn't exclude based on that. It was part of our quality assessment, so we were just looking at it individually, and it was one of the 11 points. So it was just a consideration.
You guys had a lot of comments around the lack of good evidence. Did either of the studies that you guys looked at more intensively, like that came out in your SR, did they comment on that in their discussion anywhere, that there isn't a whole lot? Okay, so that they were acknowledging it at least.
They acknowledged it in their introduction, saying the reason why we're doing this study is for that reason.
But then they didn't give any results that would have made it more clinical.
The Blumenthal one was really strange. We're still not sure why they would not give us their values.
They gave us bar graphs, but they're really unspecific, that the numbers jump in time, and then it's kind of somewhere in between, so you'd be drawing
And the quality of the graphs and everything, like, you couldn't really make sure exactly what was going on. And, yeah, it's like, for, what was it, there was another paper that's basically the exact same paper, but the authors were just in a different order, and they were saying, oh, for our results, look at this paper, and so then we found that paper, and then there was still just p-values, so not really sure what's going on.
You guys mentioned that you'd like to see the previous literature that looked at office blood pressure readings redone with ambulatory blood pressure reading. Based on what you know, I mean, in terms of the difference between what an office blood pressure reading will give you and ambulatory blood pressure reading will give you, do you expect that the intensity recommendations that were given in that previous literature will be like directly applicable to ambulatory blood pressure? Like, do you expect to see the same kind of results, or do you think that there will be a difference?
Well, it seems that it's going to be different. Like, if you look at the kind of these two studies, they kind of go through the recommendations that are used now, like the current parameters. And even though there are some flaws in the studies, what these ones show is that current parameters maybe aren't as effective as they seem to have been using office blood pressure. And so when Sarah talked before about white coat syndrome, which is, so you go into a doctor, your blood pressure goes up because you're anxious, that's almost a source of error that's in all of these office blood pressure studies. So it's like you go in there first time, you have a blood pressure measured. By the time you come back, you know, three times, you've had your blood pressure measured a bunch of different times, you become more comfortable. It's almost like there's an inherent error in the methodology of that study because people will become accustomed to it, and that's where you get a lot of the changes. So with the ambulatory blood pressure, we think there will be a difference in terms of changes in blood pressure over time because it is more of an average rather than just a snapshot each time you go in.
And the other thing is we probably find that the recommendations right now are, you know, the guidelines are 140 over 90, but if ambulatory blood pressure becomes the norm and you're getting less spikes all throughout the day, then actually that might go down. It might be more like 130 over 85 or something like that, but we'll be less susceptible to, you know, if your blood pressure goes up 20 millimeters when you go into the doctor kind of thing. So it's hard to say at this point.
I think it's pretty obvious that you guys have proved that in the fit principle of intensity, that there isn't a lot of evidence supporting what you're trying to study on. Now, have you had a chance to just really briefly look at the other elements of the fit principle, maybe it, or, whether or not they might have more evidence support behind change, manipulating those variables in order to optimize the results of exercise?
Well, as we went through these ones, so we, any study that would have fit into our criteria would have been looked at. So whether it was, you know, these ones, even though our focus is intensity, they have varying frequencies, varying types of exercise. So there's various fit principles for each of the studies. So it's not something we looked at specifically, but it's kind of inherent in the study that we had to look at each of those as we go through. So that's why in our recommendations, we thought that making a systematic strategy for going through these studies would be more beneficial so that you could say, you're going to hold all of these other variables still, so you know, same frequency, same type, same everything else, and then change the intensity and see if that makes a difference. So that's kind of the idea for our recommendation.
Oh, I was just going to say, you mentioned about the fact that the office blood pressure is actually more more variable. And so you would actually get a tighter, and possibly less change would mean more because you'd have less standard deviation as well. But you also found, like, you had two issues. One was the kind of blood pressure measured, and the other issue was whether they were randomized control trials. And I just wondered if you'd comment, because I think you were almost there, about the fact that the before-after tests have also an effect on the fact that it's an office blood pressure. You mentioned about that, so I just wondered if you wanted to explain a little further about that interactive effect of it being a before-after test and having office blood pressure.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a study, right, about blood pressure, obviously you're going to have your blood pressure measured quite a few times, and by the, you know, 50th time, you might be a little bit less anxious about it, especially if you were in the exercise or intervention group where you said, hey, I just did 6 weeks of exercise, I'm excited to see what my blood pressure readings are, or I know that there's going to be a change because I feel better. And you can imagine their levels of stress would go down with that. So
as that relates to the study design, if you don't have a control group to show that, that's probably naturally going to happen, then you can't just compare pre and post. That changes nothing.
Any other questions? You mentioned, and I'm very glad to hear the point about, you know, when you're prescribing exercise, there are several parameters, and then you addressed that very nicely, that you really need to hold those other things constant and then only manipulate the intensity. But also, you know, just given the presentation before, you know, we also would have to pay attention to lifestyle factors, right? Because you go through each one of them. You've got smoking, and if somebody's put on and there's alerting about high blood pressure, then they may be told about not smoking, about nutrition, which is, you know, about the DASH diet, dietary approaches to stop hypertension, which is independent of weight loss, as well as the relationship between sleep and hypertension, as well as stress. So, you know, it becomes, a study such as this actually becomes quite complicated when you start thinking about it methodologically. But, you know, as modest as your findings might have been, I think it's still worthy of a publication note somewhere to alert researchers to, you know, the complexity of taking this to the next step and even perhaps going forward and saying in the ideal world, what would the what would be an excellent research design to actually answer this question? I think that would be.
It's interesting that you say that about that. We just focused on exercise, right? But the Blumenthal paper, the one that didn't report any values, it just said it was a statistically significant difference. They had another group, an intervention group, that was weight management, that did exercise. They did all sorts of healthy living advice and sessions, and they saw a more statistically significant, again, we don't know how much, but mm-hmm. more than the exercise group. So obviously it does play a part in
some
interaction
there.
Yeah.
What journal was that particular?
Archives of Internal Medicine.
That's a very high impact.
Are there any remaining questions?
Good. Well, thank you very much. So look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Remember